Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young is on vacation. It's Here and Now. The New York City Fire Department today released new information recording what happened the day of the September 11th terrorist attacks. Among the materials released are some 12,000 pages of oral histories from more than 500 firefighters and emergency workers about the chaos surrounding the collapse of the World Trade Center's Twin Towers that day. The release of the information comes after the New York Times sued the city in 2002 because the city said the material was confidential. 3 years and several lawsuits later, the information is now available. Joining us on the line is New York Times reporter Jim Dwyer. He's also co-author of the book 102 Minutes, which is about what happened inside the World Trade Center on September 11th. Jim, can you explain specifically what was released today?
Yes. 12,000 pages of transcripts of oral histories that were taken of firefighters and emergency medical service workers in the months immediately after the attacks. There was also a set of dispatch tapes involving fire department dispatchers sending out apparatus and trucks and so forth. And there was a log of calls made to the emergency medical service through the 911 system.
So are some of these materials, it's my understanding, edited?
They're all edited in some form or fashion, but not terribly heavily. The oral histories, I've been going through them. It's a huge pile, and it looks like, you know, 90 to 95% of it, or maybe even more, is intact. Some of the other documents, the log to 911 is very heavily edited. However,
now, as we said, the release of this information came after a lawsuit. The fire department released a statement saying it has already voluntarily released some information. So can you briefly explain what's new about this material?
Well, this is very significant. The fire department and the Bloomberg administration have been fighting for years to keep anyone from seeing it, not only the New York Times, but the families of firefighters and the 9/11 Commission and the National Institute of Standards and Technology, all of whom wanted to have a look at it. And what's new about it, we had obtained through unofficial channels about 100 of these 500 oral histories over the last few years. And what they do is they document in a very straightforward way in the eyes of individual firefighters, fire chiefs, paramedics, paramedic officers, exactly what they experienced as they responded that day, the challenges they had, you know, both on a personal level and as professionals, what worked for them and what didn't work. And one of the things that came out very strongly, for instance, in the firefighter oral histories and continues to emerge from that, is the difficulties they had not only communicating with themselves, but there was a completely absent system for working with the other agencies, the other major agency at the scene, which was this New York City Police Department.
Have you had a chance to listen to some of the oral histories released today?
I've been reading them. They're transcribed. They're not recorded, or they're not released in recorded form. Yeah, I've been reading them, and it's just, you know, even though I've spent a lot of time covering this topic over the last 4 years, it's full of surprises. It's full of everything that happened. You know, you have all the emotions that you associate with that day. You have a great deal of shock, but also a great deal of admiration as you read through the struggles people had. At one point, I was just reading about a paramedic who they had collected all the ambulances at a certain point a block or so away from the Trade Center, and one of the bosses had all the keys. You know, you turn in the keys so that if they need to move an ambulance, they can move an ambulance. So the boss had left it on top of his car, the box of keys, and then one of the buildings fell down, and the whole place was covered with debris, and it was like a snowstorm. And he sent this paramedic. He said, "I left them on top of the Crown Victoria. Go back and get them." And well, he went back to the Crown Victoria, and it was up to the wheel wells with debris. And of course, there were no keys on top of the thing. But he somehow, rooting around in this stuff, managed to find the keys to all the ambulances, which of course would have really been terrible not to have any of the ambulances able to drive away.
Wow.
Strange little things like that, you know.
Right, right. Well, Jim, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Sure.
Jim Dwyer is a reporter for the New York Times. He's also co-author of the book 102 Minutes, which is about what happened inside the World Trade Center towers on September 11th. British officials today decided that the radical Muslim cleric who gained notoriety for calling the September 11th hijackers the Magnificent 19 will not be allowed back into Britain. Omar Bakri was arrested in Lebanon yesterday, but he was released today when authorities there said it appeared that the cleric had not committed any crime. Some, though, say that Bakri has been preaching a gospel of hate. Here's part of a sermon that he gave in London last year.
People heard what George Bush wanted to say. People heard what Tony Blair want to say. People heard what Kofi Annan want to say. People hearing every day all the leaders and the armies and the corrupted. But nobody want to hear what Almighty God, Allah, he want to say. No one has the right to legislate but Almighty Allah.
As part of a crackdown on terrorism, Bakri could face criminal charges for saying that he would not report a potential bomber to police. Well, two journalists in Britain have been providing some eye-opening views of Bakri, his followers, and other radical Muslims. One reporter went undercover, witnessing members of the group known as the Savior Sect, which is an offshoot of Bakri's disbanded group, Al-Muhajirun. Another journalist spent several weeks with Britain's largest radical Islamic group, which is Hizb ut-Tahrir, and that's been called a conveyor belt for terrorists around the world, but it is legal in Britain. And joining us to sort this out are Shiv Malik. He's a correspondent for The Independent of London, who was the first journalist allowed access to the inner circles of Hizb ut-Tahrir. Hello, Shiv.
Hi.
Also with us is Charles Hymas, acting managing editor of news for The Sunday Times, whose insight team went undercover with radical Muslims. Welcome, Charles.
Hi.
Shiv, let's go to you first. You write that you thought Hizb ut-Tahrir would be highly secretive and closed. What did you find?
Well, I found, after September the 11th, they decided to sort of adopt a different strategy. Up till that point, they had been fairly secretive and closed, and they decided to open their doors to journalists. I was the first one allowed into sort of most of their reading circles, very, very private. Reading circles where it's a sort of a cell of five people, and they have a number of these throughout the UK, possibly running into the hundreds. And I was allowed to sort of sit there and witness their meeting, in which they go through a number of books. They've got about 15 core books, which they go through, which details all their ideology. They spend a long time going through these books, roughly about 6 months to a year.
And the ideology is, can you tell us a little bit about Hizb ut-Tahrir and what the group stands for?
Yes, essentially what they say is that they want the return of an Islamic superstate known as the Caliphate, and they would use Sharia law as their basis for law, and they would use the Quran as their basis for running a lot of other systems, including an economic system. So they've worked these amazing details of economic systems out, right to the last sort of thing, on how insurance would work. Of course, then alongside all of that is the politics of it all, which then they go, well, as soon as we get this caliphate together, we'll gather an army and sort of start fighting the kafirs or the unbelievers. So they we'll do this peacefully, but as soon as they sort of take over this state, we'll gather up an army and start fighting everyone and try and take over the rest of the world. So it's a bit nutty, it's a bit crazy, it's a bit very cultish.
What about the members? What are they like?
Guys with families and kids, and a lot of them are middle class, sort of professional people. So, for example, the guy in the cell, there's five people. The mentor was an accountant. His name was Sajid Khan, and there was a trainee lawyer there. And I've met along the way during my month and a half with them. People working from Reuters, IBM, sort of computer consultants. A lot of computer consultants, even teachers working in sort of high schools and all sorts. And then they've started a new recruitment in the last 2 or 3 years, in which they're focusing again on recruiting young kids, and that's sort of starting to come through. So now you've seen sort of a second generation of very young kids who are impressionable, who are taking this on. And it's also worth noting that in London and in the north of England, there's a divide between membership. So in London, it's a lot of sort of professional, again, there's older guys and people who've been to university. But in the north, it tends to be sort of a bit more sort of economically depressed people, sort of people who've grown up without opportunities, haven't gone to university, and they, out of a sense of perhaps disenchantment, join these groups as well.
Mm-hmm. I've heard the group described as a conveyor belt for terrorists. Would you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, the group itself is They're allowed to fly outside mosques, and they're allowed to sort of, you know, have their meetings there, and they're seen as totally legitimate by the Muslim community at large. A vast majority of people see them as not a problem, and that means that people would join Hizb ut-Tahrir, realize that they're not sort of violent enough for them, and then move on. So it's just a question of strategy.
Let's go now to Charles Hymas. Charles, you're in charge of the Insight team with the Sunday Times of London, and your undercover reporter recently found that some of the members of the so-called Savior sect in the days following the July 21st attempted bombings in London, who are members of this group, what is this group about, and what do they want?
What we found is that very much they were encouraging, albeit quite carefully, young people to think about ways in which they might be able to overthrow the state, and particularly to see terrorism as a potential way in which they could do so. So, for example, you had, and I think this is what our reporter found was the most shocking thing, a particular sheikh, Omar Brooks, talking in front of young children and also teenagers, essentially extolling them to follow a course of terrorism, and that was a way of being a good Muslim. So, for example, he described to them that the fact that he'd had military training and that he did not want to go to Allah while sleeping in his bed, as he said, like an old woman. Instead, I want to be blown into pieces with my hands in one place and my feet in another. And I think to our reporter that was quite shocking, himself being a Muslim.
And this is something that the group does not publicly acknowledge whatsoever, correct?
I think there's a very clever distinction that they make about what they say publicly and what they say privately. Publicly, the laws in Britain are drawn such that in order for you to be done for inciting terrorism or inciting violence, you have to essentially identify a specific individual and tell someone to go and kill that individual. However, you can make general comments, which is what people like Bakri, who's the leader of the Al-Majahirunas, was and is obviously closely involved with the Saviour sect, the successor body. They have exploited this and will not say that such and such should go and kill such and such a person, but make general aggressive statements about the overthrow of the British state, wanting to see the Islamic flag flying above Downing Street so that they can avoid, as until now, prosecution.
Charles Hymas is acting managing editor of news for the Sunday Times. Shiv Malik is a correspondent for The Independent of London. If groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir and the Savior sect are so dangerous, should they and can they be banned? Our guests will address that question and more when we continue. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation about radical Muslims in Britain. We're speaking with Shiv Malik. He's a correspondent for The Independent of London. He spent several weeks with unprecedented access to the so-called reading circles of the fundamentalist group Hizb ut-Tahrir. And that's a group that's been called a conveyor belt for terrorists worldwide because of its focus on nonviolent ideological indoctrination. Also joining us from London is Charles Hymas. He's acting managing editor of news for the Sunday Times, and the paper placed an undercover reporter with the group known as the Savior Sect. British officials want to ban these types of groups and others, and they moved yesterday to deport some of their leaders. So, Charles, not many Americans have heard of these groups. How are they viewed in Britain?
I think that until the bombings, there was a sense that, on the one hand, people had the right to free speech, and secondly, also, as I think they were not really regarded as necessarily people who were actually going to be closely linked to any form of terrorist act. I think 7/7 and 21/7 has completely transformed the attitudes and views of people about that. And I think now is that there's been a realization that these people are essentially terrorists in themselves.
And Sheev, how do you think last month's bombings have affected Britain's views of these groups? Would you agree?
Yes, but what we're seeing at the moment is whether the ideas behind it should also be condemned. And Hizb ut-Tahrir really is at the center of this, because here's a group that specifically says, look, we're non-violent. We don't actually espouse violence. Now, in a lot of ways, this is true. They don't espouse direct violence. So, for example, if you look at their policy in Palestine, they don't support the Intifada, only because they think it's a waste of resources, and it's better to sort of, you know, fight for a super state and then have an army, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, you have to sort of condemn the ideas. So the British government has now decided to sort of think about banning them, think about very seriously about banning them, and it looks like this might actually happen. Now, for a non-violent group, that causes a lot of problems because, you know, think, okay, well, we can have free speech. I myself would say that banning it would be a very dangerous idea, because, in fact, you drive those ideas underground and you make them more illicit to the very people that they're trying to recruit, you know, those who are young. People are, you know, in second generations are undergoing a process sort of finding their identity. They don't know where they are. You know, they go back to Pakistan, they go back to India, and they sort of realize that they're not Indian or Pakistani. And they come here and they realize they're not really English either. And so these groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir, like Ahmad Shiroun, say, hey, wait, you're Muslim, and this is what you should be fighting for. So they really play upon that.
And Charles, what about the Savior sect? Is there also talk about banning that group as well? And what do you think?
Yeah, no, that does definitely face a ban. I'm not sure whether it will be effective, because what is very noticeable is with the bombings, for example, there is very little evidence of them having a wider group of connections. These are people who are totally and utterly, as it were, independent, it appears. There's no sort of controlling mastermind, and take their inspiration from wherever they want to take their inspiration. And I think that's the frightening fact that Britain faces.
Mm-hmm. And what about balancing sort of civil liberties concerns with that fear?
I think that Britain has had a very strong tradition of free speech. And the latest move that has been made, where essentially we're taking out 8 or 9 or 10 people who ostensibly have not done anything wrong except to use their language to try and motivate people to terror, will be seen by a lot of people as potentially ending that tradition.
Sheev, I'd like to ask you about a poll that I saw that the BBC published. It said it was about feelings toward multiculturalism in Britain. It said more than half of British Muslims feel that imams should preach in English, but most imams apparently do not. And now there is talk of imposing language tests on all religious leaders. How deep do you think does the belief in multiculturalism run in Britain?
Well, there's two versions of multiculturalism that exist in Britain. The first is in London. And in London, I think there's a genuine spirit of multiculturalism where there's something, it means more than just lots of cultures living side by side. People really do mix. Whereas in the north, there's a sort of sense of it's a ghettoization, really. And so that's what really needs to be tackled. And also, it's worth noting, there's we brand sort of the Muslim community. It's very diverse within itself. But the largest group is, unfortunately, also one of the most, I think, sort of insular, which is the Mirpuri community. And I think the statistic is 70% of British Muslims are from the Mirpuri community.
And can you explain that?
Yes, well, it's a specific part of Pakistan, and it's near sort of Kashmir, and it's extremely poor and extremely sort of rural as well. And they have a system called the Baradari system, which is a sort of system of brotherhood. It's like the Masons, as one person sort of said to me with a lot of experience with this. It's like the Masons, but far more intense. So they are extremely insular, and they'll only employ their own very close family members, and they're necessarily so. Now, it's not sinister. Because this is, you know, in rural Pakistan where they come from, it's needed. It's a system that's needed because, you know, the government doesn't supply things like security and justice and education. So you need sort of very close family ties. But here, all you get is a negative side because the state supplies all these other things. So you just end up with this extreme insularity. And it makes it very difficult to sort of break, I know this sounds like a horrible phrase, but break the back of that and sort of say, okay, we'll come in and be part of this wider community. So, for example, that's exactly right. A lot of imams will only speak either Urdu or Arabic. And you can't communicate that to sort of second generation and third generation kids. They sort of go to the mosque and they go, well, you know, what is he talking about? I don't understand. And they'll leave the mainstream, and they'll and easily adopted then and picked up and scooped up by these radical groups who speak English and who are, you know, sort of suited and booted in some cases, and, you know, very smart, and they're, you know, very modern, and they also understand what it is to be like second and third generation, because that's what they are themselves.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank both of you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Shiv Malik is a correspondent for The Independent of London. Charles Hymas is acting managing editor of the news for the Sunday Times of London. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young is on vacation. It's Here and Now. With fuel prices at record highs, consumers are feeling it at the pumps and at the airports. Delta, Continental, and United Airlines all announced increases in domestic fares yesterday as jet fuel prices climbed to record levels. Several other airlines are expected to follow suit. Joining us is Sally Donnelly. She covers aviation for Time magazine. Sally, with the cost of jet fuel soaring like this, how are the major carriers affected?
Well, they're struggling to meet their costs. As you know, many of them are already in bankruptcy, including United, U.S. Airways, and FlyEye, also called Independence Air, is warning that it might go in, as well as Delta. So they're looking for any money they can get, so they've slapped these ticket price increases onto consumers. But planes are so full, I can't see that passengers will complain much.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that passenger traffic is now above September 11th levels. Do you think that this price increase is going to affect those rates? And also, with those high rates of travel, why are they struggling so much?
Well, because up till now, and even going forward, ticket prices have actually been low, relatively speaking, you know, historically low. They can't make money even with the paying passengers, because the ticket prices on average have been very low. So this is going to help a little bit, but it's not going to stop the slide that seems to be occurring in the big airlines. United, obviously, already in bankruptcy, Delta threatening, and then it sometimes happens that people will predict it'll be a cookie cutter after that. You can't really compete with airlines that are in bankruptcy, because they have so many protections in terms of prices and costs. So it's going to be very difficult for the big carriers, I think. The ones who win out of this is the granddaddy of low-cost carriers, which is Southwest. AirTran and JetBlue will, I think, continue to do okay.
So analysts have expected that these high fuel costs will send Delta over the edge into bankruptcy. Do you think that'll be the case?
Well, yeah, it's always looking into a crystal ball, but they have some really tough challenges, and I don't see their prices getting down. And they also are competing against AirTran right there at their home in Atlanta. It's going to be very difficult for them. I mean, they're trying, but it's a tough environment out there.
Mm-hmm. And why does it seem to affect some carriers more than others?
Well, one, because traditional sort of problems with management. As you know, the airline industry is a small margin business in the best of times, so this is very difficult. Some of them didn't have the cash to hedge fuel, meaning buy it at a certain lower price going into the future. They didn't do that, so they're not prepared. Southwest is one that did do that. And then they have sort of traditional overhang labor problems. As you know, Northwest is in a dispute with its mechanics. They may go on strike as early as August 20th. A problem we're also seeing overseas with the British Airways strike. But it's sort of the perfect storm for airlines, and it's going to be very difficult for all of these to continue to survive.
Basically, expect the costs of tickets to go up significantly?
Well, right now, I think Delta led the way with $10 each way, and usually you fly back and forth, so that's $20 a ticket. I think the other big carriers, American, is looking at it, and Northwest, I don't think they've kicked in yet. But if they do in the next couple of days, they might keep driving it up. And they're very price-sensitive and dependent on oil, so they'll go where the market takes them.
All right. Well, Sally, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot.
Sally Donnelly is a correspondent with Time magazine. What started out as a one-woman vigil is growing into a grassroots movement. Tomorrow marks 1 week since Cindy Sheehan left her California home and pitched a tent outside of President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. Sheehan lost her 24-year-old son, Casey, in the Iraq War last year, and she wants to ask the president to bring American troops home from Iraq. The president told reporters yesterday he sympathizes with Sheehan, but pulling out of Iraq would be a mistake. Ann Sapp and her two daughters from Billerica, Massachusetts, are among the 100 supporters who have joined Cindy Sheehan in Crawford, and Ann joins us now on the line. Welcome.
Hello.
And your husband is currently serving in Iraq. Why did you decide to join Cindy Sheehan in Crawford?
I would like my husband home. I would like to see all the military come home. My husband and I don't support this particular war. We don't want to be involved in this. We don't want to see any more people die.
What is the atmosphere like in Texas?
When I arrived at the encampment yesterday, I was really struck by a group of people who have made a white cross for each soldier that has been killed. When you see the number of crosses lining this road almost as far as you can see, it really hits you what our loss is in this country.
President Bush, the Bush administration, has said that the president has met with Cindy Sheehan. Actually, the president's met with about 900 relatives of people who've been lost in the war. Why should Cindy Sheehan get another chance to speak with the president?
I think as a leader of this country, he works for us, and we, as military families, have offered up the greatest thing that we own, and that's the lives of our loved ones. And he has a responsibility to do that.
Some people say that the vigil in Texas is hurting troop morale. Does your husband know about this? What does he say?
He personally, I can read you something that he emailed me the day before I left. If there's any way to contact the woman camped outside of W's compound, please let her know that what she's doing is vital. I'm praying for her. He's told me that he feels that the work that we're doing, that the military families are doing in standing up and speaking out, is far more important than what they're able to accomplish over there.
Cindy Sheehan says she's going to stay in Crawford until the president's vacation is over at the end of this month. Will you stay that long?
I can't. I have my two daughters here with me, and they wanted to come, but 4 or 5 days is what we could contribute, and I'm happy with that.
Ann Sapp's husband, Andrew, is currently serving in Iraq. Ann and her two daughters traveled from Massachusetts to join Cindy Sheehan and about 100 other people at a vigil outside President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Ann.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We now turn to Kristen Taylor of FreeRepublic.com. His group has held pro-troop rallies since the September 11th attacks, and he joins us on the phone. Kristen, we just spoke with Ann Sapp. She wants the troops to come home. What would you say to that?
The military families going down there, I think they're sending the wrong message to our troops in Iraq, and they're also sending the wrong message to the enemy that our troops are fighting there. You know, it's undermining our troops' morale and giving aid and comfort to the terrorists over there.
She actually told us otherwise. She said her husband, Andrew, who, as we said, is in Iraq, that the actions that are happening outside of the president's ranch in Texas are actually improving troop morale because folks are thinking that maybe something will be done.
Well, that's his opinion. But I remember I was at a Senate hearing a few months back where General Abizaid said that his troops are asking him whether the American people support them in Iraq. And, it's actions like what is going on at Crawford that is leading a lot of troops to question whether the people are behind them.
But do you sympathize with Cindy Sheehan? And do you think that if the president did meet with her, that it could deflect some of the media attention?
I sympathize with her loss, of course. I'm from a military family. I've got nephews serving in the military, one who's getting ready to go to Afghanistan. So, I sympathize with her loss. But as far as whether it would defuse the media circus down there, no, I don't think it would.
Kristen Taylor is co-leader of the Washington chapter of FreeRepublic.com. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
I appreciate it.
You're listening to Here and Now. A new federal law is drastically expanding access to a treatment that could be used by thousands of people addicted to pain pills and other drugs. The law lifts restrictions on buprenorphine, a drug that's described as user-friendly and a discreet alternative to methadone. Unlike methadone, which can only be administered in clinics and requires daily supervision, buprenorphine can be taken anywhere and is available by prescription. Supporters of the drug say it offers patients safe and effective treatment for addiction without the stigma. Dr. Lynn Sullivan is an internist and assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine. Thanks to the new law, she is able to prescribe buprenorphine to her patients. Dr. Sullivan, what does this offer to patients struggling with addiction?
Well, I think one of the most important aspects of using buprenorphine is the fact that it allows patients who historically may not have come in for treatment for opioid dependence to seek out treatment and receive treatment in their doctor's offices, which I think helps kind of demystify the problem of opioid dependence and medicalize it, make it a legitimate medical disorder that you see your doctor for and receive treatment for.
And so these people were just going untreated before?
For the most part. I mean, I think it's at this point it's hard to get a handle on the actual numbers, but I think it is well known that there is a large number of patients who are not receiving treatment for opioid dependence for a number of reasons, and that buprenorphine then serves to expand access to treatment and specifically to potentially a subpopulation of patients who would not have otherwise sought out treatment because of their perception of stigma associated with traditional opiate treatment programs.
And when we're talking about opiates, what kind of drugs are we talking about?
Well, that ranges anywhere from what I think most people are familiar with in terms of heroin to what has really been an exponential increase in the abuse of prescription opiates. So pain medications that are prescribed for the indication of pain but may be abused. They have a number of trade names, but the oxycodone, hydrocodone, prescription opiates that were used for pain but may be abused for patients who have underlying opiate dependence.
Mm-hmm. And does buprenorphine appear to be successful in treating the dependence?
There have been studies that have been conducted that looked at buprenorphine and methadone head-to-head and have found that buprenorphine can be as effective as methadone in the treatment of opioid dependence. It's very important to keep in mind that there are certain patients who do very well on methadone and in methadone treatment programs, and that's where they're best treated. But there is likely a group of patients who will do very well with buprenorphine treatment, and certainly our experience and the experience of a number of physicians who have been treating opioid dependence with buprenorphine, they found it to be a very safe, very effective, as you said, very user-friendly medication.
You mentioned methadone, which is another treatment. We all have heard the studies that suggest that methadone is addictive. Is buprenorphine addictive as well?
I don't think it'd be fair to say that they become addicted. I think there is some natural physical dependence that patients will exhibit, and that's what you would expect. What we found with patients who decide to be tapered off of buprenorphine is that there is some evidence of withdrawal, which would be expected. It's a physiologic response, but it seems to be a lot less than methadone.
And the method of treatment is very different as well, yes?
Exactly. I think that what's most novel about it is that it introduces a new practice of medicine in that we have not treated opioid dependence in doctor's offices previously. And so this opens up a whole new way of treating this condition, expanding access to patients, involving physicians in part of their patients' care that they historically have not been involved with.
So do you think that signifies perhaps a change on the part of the medical community in the way addiction is viewed?
I would hope so. I think it's a huge step, or at least in my mind, it's the step towards seeing this as a medical condition, that it's not a moral failure or a behavioral weakness, that it is a biologically based condition that you can receive treatment for, it prescribed from a physician, and that it can be very successful. And my experience is that people move on with their lives, and this does not become the overarching focus of their lives, but they receive treatment, it's successful, and they get back to doing the things in their lives that are most important.
Dr. Lynn Sullivan, internist and assistant professor of medicine at the Yale School of Medicine, thank you for speaking with Here and Now.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. The former Negro League baseball star, known as Double Duty Radcliffe, died yesterday at the age of 103. Theodore Roosevelt Radcliffe was thought to be the oldest former professional baseball player. Bob Kendrick, director of the Negro League Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, says Radcliffe was a legend.
You're talking about a guy whose career began in the 20s in the Negro League. So he saw the Negro Leagues go through a lot of different stages and saw many, many other greats and was an outstanding player himself.
Radcliffe was born in Mobile, Alabama in 1902 and moved to Chicago after World War I. He went on to play for more than a dozen Negro League teams between 1928 and 1950, and he was 44 years old when Jackie Robinson, his roommate, broke baseball's color line in 1947. Radcliffe never had a chance, though, to play in the majors. Toward the end of his life, Double Duty Radcliffe lived in a retirement home in Chicago. Only a game host, Bill Littlefield, had a chance encounter with Radcliffe there, and Bill joins us in the studio to talk about that meeting and Double Duty Radcliffe. Hi, Bill.
Hey, Deb.
First off, where did he get Double Duty from?
From the best possible source. Damon Runyon, writer among writers, was attending the 1932 Negro League World Series, and he saw Ted Radcliffe catch the first game and then turn around and pitch the second game of that doubleheader. He caught a shutout in the first game and pitched a shutout in the second game, and Damon Runyon began referring to him as double duty Radcliffe and said people should have been charged twice for admission to the doubleheader.
So that's what kind of player he was, yes?
He was an extraordinary player. He was something of a showman. He had a catcher's hands. You looked at his hands and his fingers went off in all sorts of strange directions because they'd been broken so many times because of catching. And extraordinarily enough, he could still pitch with those hands. So it really was quite something.
Wow. And what about his background? Tell us a little bit more about that.
He came up with a very large family, one of 10 children. He and several of his brothers played baseball, none of them quite as well as he did, but several played professionally. And he was one of those guys who is kind of like some of the Latin American players that we see making it to the major leagues now. Baseball was a way of finding a way to make a living, a way to do something other than be hungry all your life.
Right. And you, as we said, had a chance to meet him. What happened?
Well, it was an extraordinary opportunity for me. I'm not sure how extraordinary it was for Double Duty. I was in Chicago doing a story on one of the few towns that has two Major League Baseball teams, of course, the Cubs and the White Sox. I'd finished my work. I'd packed up my tape recorder. I was hiking up the grandstand to get ready to, get a drink of water and go back to the hotel, and I saw this old man sitting all by himself in the grandstand, and I thought to myself, well, I've always had good luck with old guys. So I sat down beside him, I introduced myself, and I said, I wonder if I could talk to you for a minute about baseball. I'm doing a story for public radio.
He didn't know who he was.
I had no idea who he was, and he said, I can't talk to anybody for free. The union won't let me. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't understand. And he said, how'd you find me? And I said, I just saw you here in the stand, sir. I really nothing, I didn't know what was going on. And he said, you don't know who I am, do you? And I said, no, I don't. He said, I'm Double Duty. And as soon as he said that, I said, Double Duty Radcliffe? I hadn't imagined that Double Duty Radcliffe would still be alive, and this was 8 years ago. And then we did talk for a while, and we made a deal.
You?
He said, I can't talk to you for free. And I said, well, how much do I have to give you? He said, well, buy me some cigars. And he accepted $10. So I wrote out in my reporter's notebook a little receipt that says, I have received from Bill Littlefield $10 for cigars. And I got him to sign it. So I got his autograph without actually asking. So I have that in a frame somewhere back in my office.
And what did he tell you when you spoke with him?
Well, it was very interesting. One of the things that he talked about, and this was unsolicited. This was just something he came up with. But one of the things that he talked about had to do with his recollections of Ty Cobb, and we have some of that, I think.
Well, I played against all of them from Ty Cobb back, and we beat them. Ty Cobb was a racist. I threw him out three times in Cuba. He quit. He said, no nigga gonna throw me out, but I say, I have thrown you out. So he left.
That's a great story because Cobb left. I mean, Cobb walked off the field rather than risk being thrown out by Radcliffe a fourth time. At least that's the way Ted tells the story. He also had a good deal to say about Satchel Paige because, of course, Double Duty Radcliffe was linked with Satchel Paige in all sorts of ways, most prominently, of course, on the field when they played together in the Negro Leagues.
He and I raised up together. I was catching him when I was 13. I caught him in 9 no-hitters. That's something you wanted to know. I know.
Did Double Duty ever complain at all about being in segregated baseball?
I don't know whether he ever did. I never heard him complain. And in that way, I think he was representative of a lot of the fellows who played in the Negro Leagues. They didn't tend to complain. They tended to be very proud of what they had accomplished. He did complain about the state of current baseball. I remember him saying to me that day in Chicago, you know, we might only had 4 or 5 pitchers on the team, and they got 11 out there in the bullpen, and they can't do nothing.
And about the salaries, I presume, which were vastly different from his.
Yeah, probably so different from his that they were unimaginable. But Ted Radcliffe was doing all right. He'd made a kind of cottage industry, I think, of going to the Cooperstown, to the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. He signed a lot of autographs. He appeared, in baseball stadiums around the country, minor and major leagues, and got to throw out first balls. And there was some attention paid to him, which is all of it deserved, and that was a good thing.
But he's not in the Baseball Hall of Fame, right? Never inducted.
No. A prominent figure in the Negro League Hall of Fame, I'm sure, but not in Cooperstown. And one of the problems, of course, is that the statistics for a lot of the Negro Leaguers, so the guys who only played in the Negro Leagues and didn't have the opportunity to play in the big leagues, are so shaky. You look at the stuff on the wire services today, and some of them say Ted Radcliffe played for 15 different Negro League teams. I saw one story that said he played for 30.
right,
and so
right.
Who knows where the truth lies.
So what's your most enduring memory of him, do you think, Bill?
Well, my most enduring memory has to do with his leaving the ballpark that day. Ted was not able to travel without a wheelchair at that point, and the White Sox had a young woman, an usher, who helped him when he came to the ballpark, and she and Ted and I left the game after the 7th inning. She brought him to his brand-new red Cadillac, which had been a gift from his agent, and helped him into the car, and he asked her for a kiss, and she politely declined. And then he got behind the wheel of his Cadillac, and a police officer who was right at the entrance to the new Comiskey Park stood out in the middle of the highway, held up traffic going in both directions so that Ted Radcliffe could drive out into the highway and disappear.
it was quite stunning. Very nice. Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield, on Ted Double Duty Radcliffe, who died yesterday at the age of 103. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Have a nice weekend and join us again here and now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.